Okay. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. Obviously, end-of-life issues are very varied, very different aspects to it, whether it is related to COVID or unrelated. The questions are enormous. Probably the most discussed matter in medical ethics at large and in medicine and halacha especially. So it's really a huge topic. So just this part of the discussion, which is a substitute decision making, requires at least two aspects to it. One is the timing of application of the surrogate or substitute decision maker. And the other one is, what is he permitted or non-permitted as far as his decisions are concerned? So if we are talking about the timing of the application, we define a dying patient in halachic terminology as chayei shor. Roughly translated as a temporary life, as opposed to chayei olam, which is a long-standing expectation. So obviously, no one really talks about chayei shor in the narrow wording, which is 1 hour of life, and certainly no one talks about chayei olam as of infinite duration of life. These are parameters that have to be defined, and the surrogate or the substitute decision maker replaces the patient himself if he can't make decisions only at a time where such decisions can be made by himself, which means that there is a difference between whether he is in a chayei shor situation or in a chayei olam. So actually, in practical terms, the substitute decision making comes into effect as far as end of life decisions are concerned, only when the patient enters the chayei shor definition. It is different when he is in a situation of chayei olam, meaning that if he will be treated and the disease or the disability can be removed and hence he can live longer than chayei shor, then a substitute decision maker has only the option to decide in favor of life. He can't decide to shorten his life because the patient himself in this situation, halachically and according to many ethicists, has no power, even from an autonomous point of view, to shorten his life. And therefore, these are two types of substitute decision making. One is when it is chayei olam, then we discuss and take advice from the substitute decision maker as far as treatment is concerned. Let's say the patient needs an operation. He can't consent to it because he's incapable of making an informed consent for whatever reason, whether he's comatose or demented or under medication or whatever reason. Then, in order to agree to consent to the operation for a life-saving measure, the substitute decision maker is replacing the patient himself in accepting this decision. However, he cannot deny a life-saving measure or life-saving procedure if the patient is in a situation of chayei olam. On the other hand, if the patient is in the status of chayei shor, then the substitute decision maker can either agree or demand a life measure to be instituted or to be avoided. Here he can do both because he is substituting the patient himself. So in order to define this situation, we discussed it at previous conferences, but I think it is important to reiterate it in this particular situation. So Chai Yeshua in the Gemara has no clear definition. There are sugyos that discuss halachic issues of Chai Yeshua, but the Talmud itself did not define how long of a time is defined as a Chai Yeshua. And even the Rishonim did not relate to the timeline. It is only the Achronim, and especially current poskim, that define Chai Yeshua in time measures. And most of them, although not all, define Chai Yeshua as equivalent to Treifa. And since Treifa is 12 months, so Chai Yeshua is also defined as 12 months. 12 months is a halachic definition, but practically speaking, no disease and no physician can really define a 12-month prognosis. If a physician says that he thinks that this patient will die within 11, 12 months, he is guessing no better than anyone else. In Israel, in the Dying Patient Act that we enacted in the Knesset, we defined a dying patient or a Chai Yeshua as 6 months of life expectancy for two reasons. A, there are diseases that there are good statistics to prognosticate around 6 months. And B, even if we made a mistake and the patient, instead of 6 months, survived 8 months or 10 months, he is still within the halachic parameter of 12 months and he is still regarded as Chai Yeshua, so our decision is still applicable. Now, where do we see that Chai Yeshua is different than Chai Yoilem? That comes from the story in Melachim of the four lepers that were outside of the wall of Jerusalem because lepers are tome and they were not allowed to enter the city. And it was during the siege of Aram against Jerusalem. And they were there out. They had no food. They had no water. They had no supply because the walls were closing on the people inside Jerusalem. And they calculated, what is their best option? If they stay where they are, they'll die of hunger. If they'll enter the city, and although they are tome, but pikuach nefesh is certainly doche tuma, if they'll come into the city, both hunger and the enemies will kill them as well. So the other option was to go into the camp of Aram, and take the chance. If they'll kill us, they'll kill us. And if they'll let us live, they'll let us live. This can be done only because there was Chai Yeshua, because they had no chance to survive if they stay where they are. But if the assumption would have been that they can stay there and live longer than 12 months, as we just defined it, they would not have been allowed to take the risk that Aram would kill them. And therefore, the Gemara says that in Chai Yeshua, you can take a risk which you are not allowed to take if you have Chai Yoilem. That is by itself a very large topic. What risk can a patient take when he is dying in 10 months, but if he'll get a medication or undergo an operation, he will either die immediately and he'll lose the 12 months or the 11 months, or he'll survive more than that. Is he allowed to take this risk? That's a separate debate. But what we learn from this is that there is a concept of Chai Yeshua that is different than Chai Yoilem. And indeed, the definition of the 12 months is mentioned in the Darkei Tshuva, and actually the one that really made it stick was Rav Kook, who asked that this doesn't make it's not understandable why up to his day it wasn't defined, but someone has to define, and that is how he defined it. And most of the current poskim agree to this. Moshe Feinstein in the Tshuva, Shlomo Zalman, the only one who did not agree of the major poskim was Rav Eliashiv. When I discussed with him this question, how do you define Chayeshah? He said that if it would be true that it is 12 months, then it is treifa. So why do we need a separate term? Call it treifa. Why call it a separate a terminology? Call it Chayeshah when you actually can't distinguish between them from the period of time between them. And therefore, he decided that it's only 3 months that the Chayeshah is defined as such. Beyond that, it is already Chaye Olam. I couldn't elicit from him why did he choose 3 months? Where does it come from? Certainly, there's no source for 3 months, but that is a descending opinion. As I said, most say 12 months, and if we decided 6 months, it's based on medical statistics and not to make a mistake to go over the 12 months of this definition. So a substitute decision making to reduce the level of treatment, to withhold certain treatments, the surrogate can make such a decision, but only if the patient enters this period in his life, the same as he would do it himself if he would be capable of making a decision. So that is one aspect that I think is clear, and it kicks in, the surrogate kicks in only at this period of time. Now, what is a surrogate allowed or not allowed to decide? So obviously, he is allowed to extend life, to decide that even though the patient is in Chayeshah, he as a substitute decision maker requests to do whatever is known and possible to prolong his life. That halachically is certainly acceptable. That is acceptable for Chaye Olam, and that is acceptable for Chayeshah, assuming that he really represents the Hashkofe and the understanding of the patient. And if the patient would have been competent, he would make the same decision. So that is what the substitute decision maker is representing. The question is, if the substitute decision maker decides to reduce the level of treatment, to withhold treatment, to withdraw treatment, so that the patient will die sooner. And as I said, in Chayeshah, the patient himself is allowed to take certain decisions of this type. So the substitute decision maker is allowed to take such a decision on his behalf. Now, I think it is important to define who is a substitute decision maker. Who is this person that can take such dramatic and serious decisions on behalf of someone else? So the best would be someone that the patient himself, while still being competent, each of us, assumingly, we all are still competent. I didn't test the competency of all of you, but I assume you are. So in this stage, we can choose or elect someone that we will ask him to be the substitute decision maker. And when time comes that the person who is asking for it becomes incompetent and he enters the stage of Chayeshah, of a dying patient, then the substitute decision maker has all rights, halachic and legal, to take any kind of decision that the patient himself would have been allowed to take, which is not everything, but whatever he would be allowed. That is one type of a substitute decision maker. Another type, which I think that from an ethical point of view is a very weak substitute decision maker, and that is a surrogate appointed by the court after the patient became incompetent, which is the legal way of someone making decisions on behalf of a patient who can't make decisions on his own. So legally, there is a person who is appointed by the court. That is a very weak substitute decision maker because he was appointed after the patient became already incompetent. So what does he know what is good for the patient more than anyone else? So if he is someone that really knows, then what do we need the court for? So take his word and use it. If he is someone that the court had no choice, there wasn't someone appropriate, but they wanted someone to make sure that the patient is not abused, then his decisions are very questionable because he doesn't know what the patient would have wanted in this situation. But legally, it is accepted. The third option is a relative. And here again, on the one hand, a relative is assumed to want the best for his next of kin, and he is assumed to know what his next of kin would have wanted in such situation, because he knows his hashkofe, his poskim, whoever he goes to, his way of life, his culture, and so on. In general, that is correct. Most people, most normative people, live within their family, and it is assumed that the family really knows what the patient would have wanted in this situation, and it is assumed that they really want for the best of the patient. However, A, it is not always so, and B, not always do all participants of the family agree to the same decision. So they all seem to be substitute decision makers with the same relationship, with the same assumptions that they want the good of the patient, and supposedly they know what he wants, but they have different opinions. So on the one hand, there are, and we can't deny it, there are quarrels within families, within husband-wife, and we can't assume always that if the husband says something on behalf of his wife who is incompetent or vice versa, that he really wants or she really wants the best. Because maybe they had quarrels, they are not on the same page anymore, one wants to get rid of the other, and there are such instances as we know. Similarly, relatives, I mean, there can be a first degree relative, a brother of the patient who is now incompetent, who didn't speak with him more than 30 years, who didn't live near him. He lived in Jerusalem and the other one lived in Toronto, and they had really no real contact. But the relationship is the closest because he's a first degree relative. Is what he says is something that we can count on? So it's not always so simple. But more complicated is if there are five siblings, and everyone has a different opinion of what is best for the next of kin who is incompetent, and what would this next of kin want if he could say what he wants. So it's not so simple to decide who is the real surrogate that we can rely on that will A, want for the best of the patient, and B, know what the patient would have wanted. But once we decide on someone that he is the substitute decision maker, what can he ask and what can't he ask halachically? So on the one hand, there are positions that say that the life, the value of life or the sanctity of life is infinite. And therefore, if we say something that is infinite in a philosophical sense, it means that there are no exceptions to the rule. So if we go by this position, then it doesn't matter what the substitute decision maker says. We have to treat this patient who is incompetent, but he is still alive. By all means, by all measures, we can't stop anything. We can't withhold anything. We have to treat him even to prolong his life by 1 hour, because life is of infinite value. So then there's no place for a substitute decision maker. That, for instance, was the position of Rav Wallenberg in Tzitz Eliezer. I had some questions on his position based on other tshuvas that he wrote. I didn't get an answer when he was still alive, but that is an opinion that some poskim and some rabbis hold that this is the right way to treat any person, no matter if he has chaye oilom or chaye shor or whatever status he is in. But most poskim don't view the value of life or the sanctity of life as infinite. And actually, it's very hard to look at life as being of infinite value, because if so, how do we execute people who transgress the three major averos, the lo is yahareg v'al yavor? How do we execute a mechalel Shabbos? If life is of infinite value, how come there are so many mitzvahs that if you transgress, we are taking your life? That doesn't fit with the concept. Also, with this concept, no one would go to war, because in war, some die. And if my life is of infinite value, how can you force me to go to a danger place and to fight a war for Klal Yisrael if I might die, if my life is of infinite value? Eroi death, if someone is pursuing another one and wants to kill him, I am allowed to kill the eroi death, even though there was no judgment, there was no discussion, there was no explanation. He is allowed to be killed. If life is of infinite value, how do I kill it? And many other such examples that are very difficult to fit in the concept of infinity of life. But there are straight sources that point to the fact that indeed in dying situations, the one is permitted not to prolong the life if the person is suffering, and not use the term of infinity. So the most famous example is the day that Rabbi Yehuda Anosi, the author of the Mishnah, died. At that day, the Talmidim prayed to continue his life as long as possible, but his female servant, who was a very smart lady, that even the Talmidim used to ask her questions, she felt that his suffering is not worth continuing living, but the prayer of the pupils was so effective, like a respirator, like a dialysis machine, it was so effective that Rebbe couldn't die. So she went up on the roof, she threw a jar, it broke with a big noise, and that startled the pupils. They stopped for a minute to pray, and the Malach HaMavet was able to penetrate and take Rabbi Yehuda Anosi. So if you want, there is actually a machlokes between the pupils and the servant, whether life is of infinite value, as the pupils thought, that despite the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Anosi was already dying and was suffering, and yet they wanted to prolong his life, and the servant who said that since he is suffering and he's dying anyway, let him die. And the halacha by the Ran and many other poskim is that we go according to Amse the Rebbe, according to the servant, and actually we don't need to prolong a life of a dying patient who is suffering. Moreover, as you can see here in the slide, the Yalkut Shimoni brings a story of a woman who became very old, and she came to Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, and she said, my life is now worthless, the quality of my life is so low, I don't have any taste of the food, I can't hear, I can't see, I don't want to live anymore this way. So he asked her, what are you doing on a daily basis, assuming that this is what keeps you alive? And she said that whatever, she goes every day to shul, to daven. And apparently this is what kept her alive. So said to her, Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, don't go for 3 days to shul. She did it, and on the third day she died. So we see that if, according to Rav Wallenberg and those who are with his opinion, how could he give her an advice to die earlier? On the contrary, he should have said, maybe go 3 times to shul a day in order to live even longer, because life is of infinite value. So we see sources that it's not the case. And the most important source that life is not of infinite value and that a dying patient should be let to die is the concept of meiser hamonea, of removing the hindrance. There are a lot of examples. I don't want to go into the details. We discussed it several times already. But the bottom line is that if there is something that prevents the patient from dying, and it is not something that we need to do an act that will hasten death, it's just removing the hindrance, then we should remove it and let the patient die. So that is the concept, that a patient is allowed to ask to die sooner by withholding life-prolonging measures. And if he is incompetent and he has a substitute decision maker, depending on who this person is, as I discussed earlier, this person can make the same decision and let the patient die. Oops. Now, there's an interesting letter by the Stipeler in his book, Arianna de Gerta, which is a book that most of it deals with advices to yeshiva boys, how to learn, when to learn, what masechta to learn, all kinds of educational advice. Yet, there is one letter that is very relevant to our discussion, and he says that he heard as a child that there is a position that one has to do everything possible to prolong every life, even if the life is already at the stage of Hayeshor. And he thought that this is not according to halacha, this viewpoint. And he brings the remor about the meiser hamoneh, about removing the hindrance. And he says that actually one should let a patient die because this is a situation that is fruitless. You can't really prolong life reasonably, and there's suffering, and therefore you're allowed to do it. And this is the way Moshe Feinstein Paskin, this is the way that Rav Shlomo Zalman Paskin, and actually everyone agrees that if a patient is in a situation of Hayeshor, you are allowed to withhold further treatments and let him die sooner. There is a famous saying in the Gemara and Broches, "Afilu cherev chadam unachat al tzavaro shel adam al yimna atzmo min harachamim," meaning even if there is a sword on the neck of a person, still he should pray and ask to be saved. So here we see that no matter what, even at the final stage, you still need to ask for rachmi. So I heard from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that it says, "Afilu cherev chadam unachat al tzavaro," if there is a sore that is on the neck. But it doesn't say that the sore is already in the neck. In the neck, it's the end. Nothing can help. So why should you ask for anything? If it is on, you can remove it and maybe you will live a normal life. So therefore, there is a distinction between Chayeshor and Chayeolom, and that is how a surrogate, a substitute decision maker, has to go about. Now, there are types of treatments that in any case a patient should receive, and this is the blue group. He should receive food and fluid and oxygen and first line antibiotics, and if he's a diabetic, insulin, and if he has a acute bleeding, she should get blood and painkillers. These the substitute decision maker has to insist that the patient should receive, even if he is already a dying patient. What he can ask to withhold is resuscitation, ventilation, dialysis, surgery, chemotherapy, and so on. In other words, the distinction is between measures that are directly related to the disease of which the patient is going to die. And since he's going to die of this disease, any measure that prolongs his dying from this disease, one is allowed to withhold. But things that are unrelated to the disease of which he's going to die, he will die of them even if he would be a healthy person. If he won't receive them, he will die, such as if someone doesn't receive food and fluid, he will die of it, even though he starts as a healthy person. Therefore, even if he is a dying patient, it still is a requirement to continue with these types of treatments. So what is absolutely forbidden is active euthanasia. And as you know, there are a growing number of countries that already enacted legalization of active euthanasia, including in some measure Canada, certainly Holland, Belgium, the northern country of Australia, and many and some others. That is certainly forbidden by halachic considerations, and therefore a substitute decision maker cannot ask for such an act. Physician-assisted suicide, which started in Oregon and spread to another 7 or 8 states in the United States, again, is absolutely forbidden, and a substitute decision maker cannot agree to this act. Also, despite the fact that most Western societies allow the withdrawal even of a continuous treatment, such as a respirator or a pacemaker, halachically, that is forbidden because this is an act that directly hastens death, and there is no real difference, and I'm surprised of ethicists who make this distinction between euthanasia and withdrawal of a respirator. In both cases, you do an act, and you know that this act is going to kill the patient, and you intend to kill the patient. So therefore, this is certainly forbidden. What is permissible is to withhold further cyclic treatment, such as, for instance, dialysis. If you start a round of dialysis and then you stop it as a part of the treatment that you are giving the patient, this is how dialysis is being done. The next cycle, you can withhold. That halachically is not regarded as withdrawing, but rather as withholding. And therefore, any cyclic treatment, you can withhold the next step. So if a substitute decision maker knows that this patient is in a state of chayesho, he's receiving dialysis because he had acute renal failure, and it prolongs his life, he is allowed to ask that the next cycle will not be done, and then the patient will die. Withholding, you can withhold any type of treatment, as we said, that is pertinent to the disease of which the patient is dying, but you can't even withhold such measures that are unrelated to the dying situation and are really sustenance for every person. Now, who is the patient that we are talking about? If the patient is currently competent, he's a COVID-19 patient in a very serious situation, but he's still competent. In this case, a substitute decision maker has no status because the patient himself, in real time, should say what he wants. And therefore, we can't invoke a substitute decision maker. When can we do it? If we're talking about a patient who was previously competent, but at the moment when decisions have to be made, he became incompetent, then depends on what he did prior to becoming incompetent. If, for instance, he prepared advanced medical directives, then by law and by reason, you should go according to what he wanted. and not use a substitute decision maker. But if he doesn't have such advanced directives, then the surrogate or the substitute decision maker can enter and take decisions based on what he understood from the patient from his previous days when he was competent, and then we assume that he wants for his good, and the patient would have decided the same. A more complex situation is on patients who are dying, who are in Chayeshor, but they were never competent. For instance, someone who was born mentally retarded due to a syndrome, due to a genetic disease, whatever, but from day one, he was mentally retarded. But he grew, and he can be now 40 or 50 years of age, but he would never have been able to say what he would have wanted if he'll come to this situation. In this case, we have a problem on how to assess what he would have wanted, because there's no way to know. And then we invoke the best interest, and we assume that the substitute decision maker will take the right decision for his good. So let me conclude with a current situation in England. I don't know if you heard about it, but there is there a baby Alte Fixler, who is now around 2 years of age, who was born with severe asphyxia and a severe brain damage. She was intubated and she was treated to this point, but obviously she was never competent, even not as a baby. She didn't do anything. She's not doing anything. And she is now intubated. The parents are Haredi people, and they want at least to continue the respirator, because to withdraw the respirator, as we said, halachically, is an act of killing, and they don't want to be partner to this. But the doctors there in Manchester decided that the best interest for the baby is to remove the respirator and let it die. And their reasonings were, A, that the quality of life is so low that it's not worth living, and B, that the baby is suffering, and certainly we don't want to extend the suffering, and as long as she is intubated, her life continues, and therefore she will continue to suffer. The parents, who are the natural substitute decision makers, refused to allow to disconnect the baby. So they went to the court in England, and the judge decided that the baby should be disconnected from the respirator, because this is the best interest for the baby, and he disregarded the parents' request. It turned out that the parents are of Israeli nationality, and they asked the court to allow them to take the baby to Israel. And in Israel, the baby certainly would be continued on the respirator, because we don't kill patients by withdrawing the respirator that they are dependent on. And the judge refused to let them take the baby to Israel, because he said, if you take the baby to Israel, the baby will be continuing on the respirator, which means the baby will continue to suffer. And I decide that the baby shouldn't suffer by all means, and therefore he should stay here, we should disconnect him, and the baby should die. It went to the Supreme Court and then to an appeal on the Supreme Court. And just now, the hour that was between my previous lecture and this lecture, I got a 96 pages of a ruling of the Supreme Court, not allowing to take the baby to Israel and demanding to disconnect from the respirator, claiming that the best interest of the baby is to die. And the parents, although they are natural substitute decision makers, are doing the wrong decision for their baby. And we, the judges, know better what is good for the baby, and therefore we override the parental request And the order is to disconnect the baby. Now, I was asked to write to the Supreme Court an opinion, and I claimed the following. I said, hey, I didn't examine the baby, but I got all the medical reports. Everyone agreed that if the baby will stay on the respirator, it will live at least a few years, and it is already almost 2 years. So it's certainly not Hayeshah by any definition, even by English definition, because everyone agrees that it's 6 months to define a dying patient. So this is not a dying patient. B, halachically, to disconnect is an act of murder. So I asked the judges, would you allow to inject a little dose to the baby's heart and kill the baby? For our perspective, it's the same. You're not allowing to do it because you think it's not right to kill the baby. From our point of view, this is key. Moreover, you claim, I wrote, that the baby's brain is so damaged that there is absolute zero quality of life. If the brain is so damaged, then there is no pain and suffering, because pain and suffering is not the prick that I get on the finger. It is what my brain interprets as pain. And if the brain is non-functional, then there's no perception of pain and suffering. So why kill the baby? He's just not doing anything, but he's not suffering. And D, even if you would say that there are some parts in the brain that can perceive suffering, it is very easy to treat suffering. Today, pain is very easily detected. There are scales that both on babies and on adults who are not competent, and they can't tell us whether they have pain or not. We can easily look at it by scales, and we can provide treatment that will ameliorate or take away the pain. So if the pain is the reason to kill the baby, this is something that we can take care of. So if you will allow to bring the baby to Israel, then we will leave the baby on a respirator, but we'll take care of the pain so that the baby will not suffer. Unfortunately, they didn't accept these arguments. And the interesting point was that they said that although the belief and the religious aspect of the parents should be respected, but the baby doesn't have to follow their beliefs. The baby didn't practice anything of Jewish nature. So from their point of view, from the judge's point of view, he's not Jewish. He's Jewish by the fact that he was born to Jewish parents, but not because he has Jewish ideologies, and therefore the best for the baby would be to let it die. I don't know if it's the end of the story, but certainly from a legal point of view, it went to the highest levels, and unfortunately, this is the ruling. So a surrogate, even if he's a natural surrogate, also has limits, whether legal, sometimes halachic, but according to the scale that I just presented to you now, these are the parameters that a substitute decision maker should follow. Thank you. Laser, you're on mute.
I was just saying thank you very much. That's a huge amount of information to process, and fascinating about this case that we've all been following abroad in England, and that you should be involved in that is not a surprise to anybody. So we have lots of questions, and they are very, very involved questions. Before I do that, I just want to just give, I don't know if Rav Eddie Reichman is on today, but I want to give him a shout out because Rav Steinberg, you always quote the Karyana de Egerta of the Stipler, and Eddie, if he's here, Rabbi Reichman, just wrote an article. It was just in Parshas, that we just had it now in Parshas Pinchas, the end of Rashi quotes the Karyana de Egerta with Pinchas. And Rabbi Reichman wrote an article identifying that the question came from Rabbi Tursky, of all people. So Rabbi Tursky asked the question of the Stipler, and that's who answered him that famous answer. So if he's here, we'll speak to him about it later. So let's begin with the questions, lots of them. Rabbi Steinberg, in terms of the issue of the question of a substitute decision making, what is the role of age and quality of life? So when a person is, in the questioner's words, 80s to 90s versus a younger person, the tolerance for quality of life may vary. How does the that is how does that impact the decision, the substitute decision maker?
So in principle, and I'm stressing the word in principle, age is not a factor for life and death decisions. It doesn't matter if it's a 20-year-old soldier or if it's an 80-year demented patient, their claim for life halachically is the same. There's a tshuva by Reb Moshe and tshuva by Shlomo Zalman Loyerbach and many others that age should not be a decision factor. Moreover, even in triage decisions, even if you have limited resources and you have a younger person and an older person, you shouldn't prefer the younger only because of age. So age per se is not a factor at all. And we treat, certainly in Israel, we treat the elderly the same way we treat the younger. And that is, from the age point of view, a non-factor. However, because of age, there are medical complications. The older the person gets, many of them, not all, many of them have diseases, have disabilities, which may turn them to become a chayeshor by the fact that they have the accompanying illnesses. And then we treat them as a chayeshor based on their medical condition, not based on their age. We know very old people who function very well and they can survive after a heart attack and after a stroke, and people can live sometimes a lower quality of life, but quality of life per se in halacha is not a criterion except for pain and suffering. If it is unbearable, if you can't take care of it, that is a sufficient reason not to prolong life. And that actually what the servant of Rebbe took into account, because she said that Rebbe is suffering, Avekam Itzter, she said he was suffering, therefore she thought that they shouldn't prolong his life. So a substitute decision maker should act only from a medical point of view and not from the social point of view.
Thank you.
Having said that, it's not as simple as said, because advanced dementia per se can become at certain stages a limiting life factor, and therefore it may become a medical indication not to prolong life, but certainly not to shorten life. So these are very delicate situations where you have to assess, why don't you prolong a demented patient's life? Is it just because he can't follow what we are talking now in this conference? Or is it because his medical condition deteriorated to become a medical reason for chayeshor?
Thank you very much. One of the questioners, if the Rav can speak to the issue of at what point do we define competence? I guess this is a very complex question. Many disease processes, such as dementia, are progressive in nature. At what point would it be reasonable to invoke an SDM?
Right. So in Aloha, we distinguish between two concepts: a peti and a shoite. A peti is someone whose intellectual ability is lower than an average. So he can be a nice fellow, he can be a cooperative fellow, but his cognitive abilities are low. So here there are all kinds of definitions. What level of cognitive function is still acceptable, for instance, to accept him to a minyan, to say omen after his blessings, and so on. So there are various definitions, especially functional ones. Does he comprehend the fact that there is a God? Does he go to a store and understands that in this store you buy bread and not nails, or things of this sort that you can assess very roughly, and it's sufficient to put him into the category of someone who can have a bar mitzvah and aliyah Torah or not. So this is one level. A shoyte is someone that is unresponsible, that he is doing things which are unresponsible. He's losing everything. He's walking at night. He's, when it was unusual to do today, many people walk at night. I don't know how normal they are, but that is not necessarily a sign of a shoyte, but according to the Gemara in those days it was. So any behavior that is totally out of the range of what in general is accepted as normal is a shoyte. Now, a demented person can have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, or in different stages can be this and later that. And therefore, depends at what stage you talk to him, you assess him. If he is at the beginning, that he forgets things, that he doesn't remember things, that he doesn't remember where he placed things, that is still a level of a petty, because he still remembers things from the past. If you talk to him now, he answers correctly. In a minute, he may forget what he wanted to say, but he's still acting in a normal way. This is a petty. And a petty certainly, from a perspective of life and death, certainly has all rights to be alive. And even from a halachic point of view, there are certain things that he certainly can still fulfill. Once the demented patient deteriorates further and he acts in a way that the behavior doesn't make any more sense, and he forgets even the past, and he can't recognize people, and he can't recognize actions, that is already a stage where he might not be able to fulfill mitzvahs. But still, as far as life and death is concerned, there is no halachic heter that I know of not to treat him. He's still alive. He has a different quality of life. And by the way, some people say that in some stages of dementia, maybe he is happier than we that see all the bad things around us and feel all the bad things that we have, and we may be more miserable than he is when he doesn't really realize what's going around. And then he deteriorates to a stage, some divided to seven stages, the Alzheimer dementia, six or seven is a situation where he stops eating, when he stops totally to connect with the world. And usually these are already signs that he's going to die. These are already signs that put him in the category of Hayeshah. And perhaps at this stage, one is allowed to make a decision of withholding treatments or certain treatments, as with a dying patient. So it very much depends on the stage and on each individual. Some go very quickly, some can stay at a certain stage for many years, and so on.
Thank you. So in the span that we just finished speaking, I just looked at my chat and I have 15 new messages. So I don't even know how that's going to happen. Rabbi Steinberg, one of the issues that comes up often is that there are advanced directives, there are living wills. What does the Rav say about halachically? Should people, implement these tools? Should they actively have that kind of a conversation?
Well, I think that in our day and age, when we don't know where we will end, once we become incompetent, we may be involved in a car accident in a different city, or we can wander up to a different hospital and not necessarily people knowing our past and what we would have wanted and so on. So I think it is right to have something that will represent what I want. So there are different levels of representation. One is a detailed advanced directive, which is much more than a living will. Usually a living will means that I wrote a general statement when I become incompetent and I can't do this or that, don't treat me anymore. That is usually very broad and very wide, and it's very hard to understand in real life situations what he really had in mind. An advance directive is a much more detailed document that goes over each and every possible treatment that people may need in end of life. And you can say, this I want then, and this I don't want. The problem is manifold with this. A, when a person is healthy and he looks at life the way he is now, to think about being demented and old and fragile, I don't want such a life. But once you get closer to this age and stage, many people change their minds. Here they want to see a wedding of a grandchild or bar mitzvah of a great-grandchild, and you want still to live and you want to be part of society, and you may have changed your mind, but the document is there, and when something happens to you, they'll act other than what you really want now. And obviously the vice versa also exists, that now I think whatever will happen, I want to live no matter what. But once someone becomes sick and suffering, he doesn't want it. And again, there might be confusions. And also, no one can foresee really the real situation and what exactly treatment will do to me in this particular situation. It is never exactly as happens, and therefore it might not represent well what I wanted. In my opinion, the best is to appoint a substitute decision maker, which is that I appointed, not that the court appoints after I'm not competent anymore. This, to me, from an ethical point of view and from a halach point of view, is almost useless. But if I now decide that I want my wife or my son or my daughter or whoever it is that I trust, I want them to make decisions on my behalf when I become incompetent, assuming that I talk with them and I tell them in more detailed or less detailed fashion what I would be willing at the end of life, without going into exact definitions, that A, if it's written as a legal document, at least in Israel, it is binding. This substitute decision maker that I appointed is binding legally. And halachically and morally, I think this is the best way to represent me when time comes. Now, if I am an Orthodox Jew, I can add to the appointment of this substitute decision maker that he or she should consult with a rabbi or with this rabbi or with this type of rabbis or whatever, so that the burden on this substitute decision maker will not fall totally on their shoulders. It's sometimes not an easy task to do. And therefore, my advice or my request is it should be according to the halachic framework, and therefore they should consult with the rabbi. So if you do these two things, you appoint a substitute decision maker, you yourself appoint him when you are competent, and you advise or you ask them to consult with the rabbi, I think that it's probably the best way not to fall into situations where there are fights and debates on what to do.
Thank you. I'm going to try to combine two questions here in the hope that we will be able to. So one point is, if let's say no conversation takes place, but there is a substitute decision maker. In other words, number one, the question is, how many situations and how detailed of a conversation must there be to, in fact, to appoint an SDM? Or is it enough to just say, one person is the SDM without going into the micro details of cases? And the second question would be, imagine there was always going to be difficulties between where the person and the SDM are going to be different in halacha, for example, orthodox, non-orthodox. But let's make this even more dramatic, where the person who is appointing, he holds by Rav Waldenberg, And the SDM holds by Rav Eliashiv or Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And therefore, the challenges are very, very, very much obvious in terms of how they proceed. What does the Rav have to say?
Okay, so on the first question, the more detailed the discussion is, makes it easier on the substitute decision maker. That is obvious. And we don't have to talk about it at one session Friday night after dinner. It's not the appropriate time to discuss it, but we can do it along the way. Once I'm telling her one thing, once another thing, and slowly she gets the picture, and assuming that she knows my character, my talks, and so on, she will know approximately what would fit me best. Now, if it is how halacha should be interpreted in the case when it comes, in the actual situation, obviously, the substitute decision maker, as it says, he's a substitute decision maker, he should make the decision according to the patient, not according to him. So the example that you gave is in a way easy, because if the patient wants to go according to a Waldenberg and he wants to do everything for him, Rav Eliashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach won't be against it. Obviously, if this is what he wants, that is easy. What the question, the more difficult question is the opposite. If I am going according to Rav Shlomo Zalman and I don't want certain treatments, but the substitute decision maker is a Talmid of Waldenberg and he thinks it's terrible to do it, and how can he do it? Here, I think again, it's the same thing, that he should do what the patient wants, as long as both are Orthodox, as long as there is a poisek that you can rely on. Obviously, there is a machloikis on each and every step that we take in life. There's nothing without a machloikis. Someone has said once that if there is a halacha that there was no machloikis in it, no one knows the halacha. That's a halacha that no one knows. You know it only because you heard the machloikis and then you know the halacha. So certainly in end-of-life issues, there are various opinions. We sometimes, I just recently got a question of a person who is totally non-full. He doesn't care about halacha. And his son, who was the substitute decision maker, is a Baal Teshuva, and he doesn't want to act on behalf of his father the way his father wanted, because what his father wanted is clearly against halacha. What do you do in this situation? So halachically, it was easy for me to say, you should do what is right halachically, at least at the minimum level, which I hope your parents Be'olam Abba will agree with what you did, because they had a mistake during their lifetime. But legally, he can't do it. Because legally, if he is the appointed substitute decision maker, he has to do what his father or mother wanted. And if clearly they wanted a certain way, even if it's according to halacha, supposedly he has to do what they do. So I told him that either he convinces his parents to at least amend the general orders that they gave him so that it will fit into any halachic position. Otherwise, he should refuse to do it, because he can't be the substitute decision maker, do against his parents or do with his parents against halacha. Both ways are impossible.
Okay, thank you very much, Herr Steinberg. I think, Rabbi Jay, I think we're going to have to move on, right?
Okay. Not a bad idea, yes.
All right.
Even though Dr. Pelkovitz graciously encouraged that we should take as much time with questions, we are a bit over, and I think we should take a 4-minute, 20-second break, and then Dr. Pelkovitz can continue at 12:35 and 42 seconds.
Before we break, I just want to do a couple of housekeeping sure. items. First of all, I want to thank Rabbi Steinberg again, really, for, as always, a master of craft. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your insight. Before we take that 3.5 minute break,
several
questions which have come up that I just want to just address to the for housekeeping. We will try to arrange the that the PowerPoints will be available on the Torah Motion website, so you will be able to have the slides. The CME credits, there are available. And again, we will, if you follow the Torah in Motion website, you'll log in and you'll be able to answer the questions and then for the evaluation, and you will get your CME credits for that. So we will take a 3 minute break now. And
you can make it 4 minutes. We can keep it at
4 minutes. And we will return with Dr. Pelkovitz.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Steinberg. Always a pleasure. And regards and be well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we look forward to Mirtz Hashem next year, you and your wife, to get together in person.
Hopefully.
Okay. Yes, be well.
We have enough questions to do 2 Shalosh Shudasim.
That's for sure.